By the end of the year, George W. Bush seemed well on his way to winning the Republican nomination, as several of his challengers dropped out, leaving only Senator John McCain with any chance of stopping him. I had been impressed with Bush's campaign since I first saw him articulate his compassionate conservative theme in a farm setting in Iowa. I thought it was a brilliant formulation, virtually the only argument he could make to swing voters against an administration with approval ratings in the 65% range. He couldn't dispute the fact that we had 19 million new jobs, the economy was still growing, and crime was down for the seventh year in a row. Instead, his compassionate conservative message to the swing voters was this: I'll give you the same good conditions you have now with a smaller government and a bigger tax cut. Wouldn't you like that? On most issues, Bush was in line with the conservative congressional Republicans, though he had criticized their budget for being harsh to the poor. Although Bush was a formidable politician, I still thought Al Gore would win, despite the fact that only two previous vice presidents, Martin Van Buren and George H.W. Bush, had been elected directly from the vice presidency. I thought Al would win because the country was in good shape and our administration had strong support. All vice presidents who run for president have two problems. Most people don't know what they've done and don't give them credit for the accomplishments of the administration, and they tend to get typecast as number two men. I had done everything I could to help Al avoid those problems, by giving him many high-profile assignments and making sure he received public recognition for his invaluable contributions to our successes. Yet even though he was indisputably the most active and influential vice president in history, there was still a gap between perception and reality. The biggest challenge Al faced was how to show independence while still getting the benefit of our record. I thought he should say that no matter who became the next president, change was inevitable. The question for the voters was whether we should keep changing in the right direction or make a U-turn to the failed policies of the past. Governor Bush was clearly advocating a return to trickle-down economics. We had tried it that way for 12 years, and our way for 7. Our way worked better, and we had ample evidence to prove it. All during the Christmas season, we were looking forward to New Year's Eve in the new millennium. My friend Terry McAuliffe had raised several million dollars so that we could offer citizens from all over America a chance to enjoy the festivities in Washington, which included 2 days of public family activities at the Smithsonian Institution, and on the 31st, a children's celebration in the afternoon, and a concert produced by Quincy Jones and George Stevens with a big fireworks display. We also had a large dinner at the White House filled with fascinating people from literary, artistic, musical, academic, military, and civic circles, and a long dance after the fireworks on the Mall. It was a wonderful evening, but I was nervous the entire time. Our security team had been on high alert for weeks due to numerous intelligence reports that the United States would be hit with several terrorist attacks around the millennium. Since the embassy bombings in 1998, I had been focused intently on bin Laden and his al-Qaeda supporters. We had rolled up a score of al-Qaeda cells, captured terrorist operatives, broken up plots against us, and continued to urge Pakistan and Saudi Arabia to pressure Afghanistan to give bin Laden up. Now, with these new warnings, Sandy Berger convened all my top national security staff in the White House virtually every day for a month. One man with bomb-making materials was arrested crossing the Canadian border in Washington State. He had planned to bomb the Los Angeles airport. Two terrorist cells in the Northeast and one in Canada were discovered and broken up. Planned attacks in Jordan were thwarted. The millennium came to America with lots of celebration and no terror, a tribute to the hard work of thousands of people, and perhaps to a bit of luck as well. Regardless, as the new year, the new century, and the new millennium began, I was filled with gratitude. Our country was moving into the new era in excellent shape. Hillary and I began the first day of the new century and the last year of my presidency with a joint radio address to the American people. We'd stayed up with the revelers at the White House until about 2:30 in the morning, and we were tired, but eager to mark this day. We discussed the remarkable worldwide celebration that had taken place the night before. Billions of people had watched on television as midnight broke, first in Asia, then in Europe, then Africa, South America, and finally North America. The United States was entering the new century of global interdependence with a unique combination of economic success, social solidarity, and national self-confidence, with our openness, dynamism, and democratic values being celebrated the world over. Hillary and I said that we Americans had to make the most of this opportunity to keep making our own country better and to spread the benefits and share the burdens of the 21st century world. That's what I intended to spend my last year doing. My last State of the Union address was a joy to deliver. We had more than 20 million new jobs, the lowest unemployment rate and smallest welfare rolls in 30 years, the lowest crime rate in 25 years, the lowest poverty rate in 20 years, the smallest federal workforce in 40 years, the first back-to-back surpluses in 42 years, 7 years of declining teen births and a 30% increase in adoption, and 150,000 young people had served in AmeriCorps. Within a month, we would have the longest economic expansion in American history, and by the end of the year, we would have 3 consecutive surpluses for the first time in more than 50 years. I was concerned that America would become complacent in our prosperity, so I ask our people not to take it for granted, but to take that long look ahead to the nation we could build in the 21st century. I offered more than 60 initiatives to meet an ambitious set of goals. Every child would start school ready to learn and graduate ready to succeed. Every family would be able to succeed at home and at work, and no child would be raised in poverty. The challenge of the baby boomers' retirement would be met. All Americans would have access to quality, affordable health care. America would be the safest big country on earth, and debt-free for the first time since 1835. Prosperity would come to every community. Climate change would be reversed. America would lead the world toward shared prosperity and security, and to the far frontiers of science and technology. And we would at last become one nation, united in all our diversity. I did my best to reach out to Republicans as well as my fellow Democrats, recommending a mix of both tax cuts and spending programs to move toward the goals, greater support for faith-based efforts to fight poverty and drug abuse and help teen mothers, a tax break for charitable contributions by low and moderate income citizens who couldn't claim one now because they didn't itemize their deductions, tax relief from the so-called marriage penalty and another expansion of the earned income tax credit, greater incentives to teach English and civics to new immigrants, and passage of the hate crimes bill and the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. I also thank the Speaker for his support of our New Markets Initiative to give unprecedented incentives to investors to put their funds into communities that had been left out and left behind. As always, I introduced the people sitting with Hillary who represented what we were trying to accomplish. The father of one of the students killed at Columbine High School in Colorado, who wanted Congress to close the gun show loophole in the Brady Bill. An Hispanic father who proudly paid child support, who would benefit from the tax relief package for working families I had proposed. An Air Force captain who had rescued a downed pilot in Kosovo to illustrate the importance of finishing our work in the Balkans. And my friend Hank Aaron, the home run king who had spent his years after baseball working to help poor children and to bridge the racial divide. I close with an appeal for unity, reminding Congress that even Republicans and Democrats were genetically more than 99.9% the same. I said, modern science has confirmed what ancient faiths have always taught. The most important fact of life is our common humanity. On Sunday afternoon, February 6th, Hillary, Chelsea, Hillary's mother Dorothy, and I drove from Chappaqua to the State University of New York's campus in nearby Purchase for Hillary's formal announcement of her Senate candidacy. Hillary gave a terrific speech, one she had written carefully and practiced hard. It displayed how much she had learned about the concerns of the different regions of the state and how clearly she understood the choices voters were facing. She also had to explain why she was running, show that she understood why New Yorkers might be wary of voting for a candidate, even one they liked, who had never lived in the state until a few months before, and say what she would do as a senator. She did it all very well. The presidential nominating process was over by the second week of March as John McCain and Bill Bradley withdrew after Al Gore and George W. Bush won big victories in 16 Super Tuesday primaries. Bill Bradley had run a serious campaign, and in pressing Al early, had made him a better candidate, as Al scrapped his endorsement-laden approach for a grassroots effort in which he looked more like a relaxed but aggressive challenger. Bush had righted his campaign after losing in New Hampshire to McCain by winning in South Carolina, aided by a telephone campaign into white households, reminding them that Senator McCain had a, quote, black baby. McCain had adopted a child from Bangladesh, one of the many reasons I admired him. As June drew to a close, I announced that our budget surplus would exceed $200 billion, with a 10-year projected surplus of over $4 trillion. I recommended that we lock away the Social Security surplus, about $2.3 trillion, and that we save about $550 billion for Medicare. It was beginning to look as if we could handle the baby boomers' retirement after all. Most polls had Gore trailing Bush, and at my press conference on June 28th, I was asked by an NBC News reporter whether I was being held accountable for the scandals of the administration. I said there was no evidence that he was being punished for my mistake, that the only wrongdoing he had been accused of involved campaign fundraising and he wasn't guilty, and that the other so-called scandals were bogus. The word scandal's been thrown around here like a clanging teapot for 7 years, I said. I knew three things about Al Gore. He had had a more positive impact on our country as vice president than any of his predecessors. He had the right positions on the issues and would keep the prosperity going, and he understood the future, both its possibilities and its dangers. I believed if all the voters understood that, Al would win.